As Rob said, I'm Stephen Ezell. I'm the Vice President of Global Innovation Policy at the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, ITIF. We are a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan science, technology, and economic policy think tank of about 20 people whose mission is to advocate for public policies, laws, and regulations that drive innovation-based economic growth in the United States, in our states, and in countries around the world. We're not the largest, but we were ranked by the University of Pennsylvania Global Go-To Think Tank Index 2 years ago as the world's leading science and technology policy think tank. So we're proud of that. Rob asked me to cover four topics with you today. First, what is innovation and how can we inspire it? Second, a look at what are some of the key and most interesting emerging technologies that are going to impact regional and indeed national economic growth in coming years. Third, how's Montana and the region doing on innovation? And four, what would be some advice for policymakers? Sound good? All right, so what is innovation? Well, speakers touched on it earlier, but really innovation, the formal definition, is that it is the creation of new or the improvement of existing products, processes, services, and organizational business models. Okay, that's true, but it's a pretty lame definition, right? I think a better definition is that innovation is fundamentally about the transformation of existing conditions into preferred ones. Innovation is about the creation of new value for the world and the creation of transformed futures that we want to live in. I think it's also important to recognize that innovation is something that states, provinces, and countries around the world are fiercely competing for. In 2011, my colleague, our president, Robert Atkinson, and I wrote this book called Innovation Economics, The Race for Global Advantage, in which we document that at least 75 countries around the world have formalized national innovation strategies and often national innovation foundations whose goals is to explicitly help their states and their country attract, scale, grow, and incubate industries and enterprises in the highest value-added sectors of economic activity. Every community in the world is competing with one another to be leaders in the innovation and sectors of tomorrow. So I think it's important to recognize that what you're doing here, your tech sector, your photonics sector, it's in competition globally. Now, innovation is vitally important, but I think you would agree with me that innovation is actually very difficult to achieve. So would it be okay if I gave y'all a few puzzles to ponder? Okay, first question. Do you recognize who this gentleman is and what that device is? I'll give you a hint. A lot of people say it's a bong. He's getting high. It's not the case. But maybe, does he look familiar to anybody there? Who's that? Alexander Graham Bell. And that is, of course, the very first phone, right? It's the prototype for the phone. So the year is 1876. And what does Alexander Graham Bell have? He has that. He has the prototype for a phone and technically the patent. But does he have any customers? Does he have a supply chain, a distribution network, telephone or wireless lines to take the product to market? No, that's all he has. So what do? Well, the obvious thing, as Alexander Graham Bell did in 1877, was to go to Western Union, of course, which had all the telegraph lines around the world. And Bell offers to sell the patent for the phone for the princely sum of $100,000. Does anybody know what William Upton's exact words to Alexander Graham Bell were? Quote, "Nobody is interested in what is just a toy." 2 years later, Upton realized his mistake, came back, tried to buy the patent for the phone for the princely sum of $25 million. But by then, Alexander Graham Bell knew what he had, AT&T was born, and the rest was history. We can do any number of examples like this. A century later, we could have asked, why didn't AT&T itself create America Online? In fact, AT&T did try and create an online access division called AT&T WorldNet, But inside the company, it was killed because its profits initially weren't as much as the long-distance telephone division, so it wasn't profitable. The company killed it, and America Online had the opportunity. As I said, we can do any number of examples. I was actually working at the NASDAQ stock market in the early 2000s, New York City. I was there at NASDAQ the day that Google went public in 2002. At the very same time, Microsoft and its then president, Steve Ballmer, had a conference call with investors that very morning. And I listened in as Steve Ballmer said, quote, "Google is nothing but a house of cards, and I expect it to go bankrupt within 2 years." But why didn't Sears create Walmart or American Airlines Southwest? I ask you, why do we see continual cases of established companies who should know their industries and their markets and their technologies better than anybody else in the world, and yet they continually miss out on these profound opportunities for innovation? I ask you, why? Why does this keep happening? So speak up if you would. Right? We're not interested in the opportunities that seem peddling today. Exactly. Right? Great. Precisely. Lack of vision. Lack of courage to face the future. Anybody else? Risk aversion. Yeah, so I think this is all exactly right. And I teach a week-long class on innovation and entrepreneurship in Berkeley every year to a bunch of Norwegians, and I try and distill this down to three lessons, although there are others, and you've all said them. But I think the first point is that fundamentally, it takes effort to stand in the future and to see new possibilities. But that's fundamentally the role of the innovator or the entrepreneur, is to stand in the future and see a vision of a world or society or a company or a community transformed. It's like Steve Jobs said, it's only the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world who actually do, right? So you have to stand in the future and vision a new reality. Second, as you said, just because you're not willing to disrupt or cannibalize your own business does not mean that there's not somebody else out there willing to come along and do it for you. And third, I think too many companies and even nations don't recognize the need to innovate until it's just too late. And I think a great example of this is a company you might have heard of called Kodak. Founded in Rochester, New York, 1891. Late 1990s, early 2000s, the company is at an all-time high in terms of stock price, number of employees, $16 billion in revenue. China had just joined the World Trade Organization, massive opportunity to sell film and camera to this new society that wants the trapping of, you know, a consumer life. Yet within 13 years, this company would go from an all-time high to being bankrupt in 2012. And the day that Kodak went bankrupt, it was the third most well-recognized consumer brand in the entire world. What on earth happened that the company drove it into bankruptcy? Well, actually, the answer goes back to the year 1979, when this gentleman, Steve Sassoon, invented and received the patent for the very first digital camera. And the next year, Steve is invited up to give the briefing on this new technology to the C-level executives assembled in Rochester. And, you know, this tall, lanky, engineer walks in with this ungainly 8-pound prototype. Do you think the managers at Kodak saw the future in this guy or this technology? Anybody know exactly the words were that Ken Whitaker, the president of Kodak, said to Steve after he gave his presentation? Very close. Whitaker's exact words, as quoted in the New York Times, were, quote, "Steve, that's interesting, but do not tell anybody about it." And the reason why was because Kodak made 95 cents on every dollar you spent on celluloid film. They recognized that in a world in which digital photography prevailed, their profit per photo taken would fall to pennies on the dollar. So Kodak's response was to delay the advent and introduction of digital photography technology for as long as they possibly could, wasn't until 2004 that they released the Kodak Advantix camera, their first fully digitalized camera. That did okay in the market for 2 years, but then the iPhone came along and completely disintegrated the opportunity. It was estimated Kodak spent over $1 billion developing digital photography technology, never made any money off of it. But do you guys remember growing up the Kodak commercials? If you'd see these in your kids, these Kodak commercials, it would be the family at Epcot Center or Disney World or the Eiffel Tower, and you know, just 30 seconds of the family walking around and photos being taken. And then at the end, the woman would come on and she would intone, "Kodak, sharing memories, sharing lives." If our business is really about helping people share memories, share lives, how hard would it be for us to take this new thing called the internet, maybe give people the capacity to post their photos online, tag themselves, say who they were with, right? Kodak's future was Facebook, right? But Kodak can never make the leap from manufacturing products to creating consumer experiences delivered digitally through a new business model. So their failure to face the future and embrace and adapt to new technology was their undoing. Let's look at a company that I think gets it more right. Consider the evolution of the bookstore. That's what the bookstore looked like, the brick and mortar bookstore in the 1990s. By 2003, this was the bookstore, the Amazon Fulfillment Center outside Seattle that could hold 1.5 million titles and get them to you at the click of a button. But by 2007, this was the bookstore, right? The data center delivering the ebooks to the Kindle. And today, this is the future of delivery. But if you listen to Jeff Bezos tell it, he says, Amazon is in the business of putting Amazon out of business. What on earth does that mean? Well, it means he wants it to be Amazon that is disrupting Amazon's old business model before somebody else comes along and does it to them. They want to be forcing the future onto their competitors, not having it be forced onto them. And I think that's the mentality of the innovator. I think another important point here is to look at what guys like Sergey Brin and Larry Page have done at Google. They set radically ambitious goals for their company. When Google was founded, they set a mission to, quote, organize all of the world's information and make it instantly accessible and usable for society. Does that sound like a company you might want to get up in the morning and go work for? Right? They inspire their people with meaningful calls to action. And I think especially for the millennial generation, which seeks meaning in their work, this is vitally important. Musk is another guy like that, Elon Musk at SpaceX. He says that his goal is to make human life interplanetary, and that he fervently hopes he dies on Mars, but just not on impact. Finally, I think it's important to note that there are really fantastic tool sets out there, systematic, formalized processes that companies and entrepreneurs can use today to think about how to innovate in a systemic way. There is not a better book in the world on innovation than this book, The 10 Types of Innovation, by Larry Keeley out of a company called Doblin in Chicago. Essentially, he posits that most companies focus only on innovating the core product or service they make, and they miss profound opportunities to innovate with regard to their internal processes, their financial model, or their delivery system about channel, brand, customer experience. I won't teach you these books today, but I will say I would highly recommend every government agency, every company, to invest some time in reviewing this literature and teaching your people the methods of innovation that leading companies use today. So those are some thoughts on what is innovation and how to inspire it. Shall we take a look at some of the new emerging technologies that might impact your economy in the future? So I think what is interesting is how profoundly the world can be changing around us, yet we're not always quite conscious of it. Take a look at this photo taken in the year 2005. All right, you guys are in Rome, in St. Peter's Square, looking up at the Basilica, the Vatican. This photo was taken the day that Pope Benedict had the papal inauguration in 2005. Take a look at a photo shot from the exact same vantage point 8 years later, the day Pope Francis became Pope. In a short 8 years, we have equipped the lot of humanity with a communications and computing device that has more power than the space shuttles we sent up in the early 1990s. Not only that, whether it's an iPod or a mobile phone, you have platforms for commerce that essentially can simultaneously aggregate supply and demand for virtually every marketplace in the world, whether it's states, jobs, transportation hailing, Airbnb. It's incredibly powerful. And I think it speaks to the point that information and communications technologies are the modern global economy's greatest drivers of growth. In fact, it's anticipated that fully 50% of all value created in the global economy over the next 10 years will be created digitally. What's interesting is that historically, competition was only within ICT industry verticals. So we used to have, in personal computers, companies like Compaq competing with Dell, right? And then we moved into the mobile era, and there was competition between Nokia and Motorola and Samsung. But the point is that the information technologies we have today, like the Internet of Things, cloud computing, artificial intelligence, big data, social media, etc., have essentially become so powerful that they've allowed competition to spill out beyond ICT industry verticals. And so now these technologies are being used to disrupt virtually every industry, whether it's transportation with Uber, hospitality with Airbnb, finance with Bitcoin and Kickstarter. So the power of digital technologies to disrupt established and legacy industries has become incredibly profound. I'd like to address five technologies in particular that I think are particularly relevant to the regional economy. Artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, smart city applications, quantum computing, and life sciences innovation. So what is artificial intelligence? Essentially, it is the scientific understanding of the mechanisms underlying human thought and intelligent behavior and their embodiment in software code and machines. But it's also an incredibly powerful economic opportunity. It's expected that AI will add $13 trillion to the global economy over the next 10 years, potentially raising America's annual productivity growth by as much as 2%. And far from being something we should fear, it actually holds the potential to create hundreds of thousands of jobs going forward. More than that, the capability of AI has increased substantially in the past 5 years. And I'd like to show a short video showing that. Mike, if you would. So what we're going to see here is Google DeepMind learning how to play the classic Atari game Breakout. The algorithm is given nothing more than the rules of the game and the objective to maximize score. It has no domain knowledge, no training on method or technique. It's just learning it as it goes. So over the first 10 minutes, the game is pretty clumsy. It's learning in real time the best methods and techniques to succeed. Probably like me when I started out, I think. However, after 2 hours, 120 minutes of training, the game plays like an expert. So it's continually learning. So at this point, it's as good as most humans can be at the game. However, it keeps playing, it keeps learning, and after 4 hours, 240 minutes, it's keep getting more intelligent. But essentially, what the game is able to do is to find a mechanism of tunneling around the wall that even the game's designers never envisioned or thought possible. After 4 hours of gameplay, it discovered a strategy to win that no human ever had. And scientists estimate that where artificial intelligence is today in terms of its cognitive capacity would be somewhere between where insects and birds are.
but that by the year 2040, artificial intelligence should reach a level of cognition that would be equivalent to humans. Now, I know that sounds scary, but I come from Washington, D.C., and there are a lot of not very intelligent people in Washington. I wouldn't be too critical about this. I think more important is to focus on some of the practical applications of artificial intelligence that are going to improve our daily lives. We wrote a report, which is available for you at the back, called The Promise of Artificial Intelligence, which provides 70 real-world examples of how AI is used in sectors like business, energy, environment, disaster management, etc. And it notes that AI can be really grouped into 7 typologies for its functions. First, AI is great at monitoring, rapidly analyzing large amounts of data and detecting abnormalities and patterns. So it will be very effective for things like credit card monitoring and cybersecurity intrusion detection. It'll be great at discovering or extracting insights from large data sets. IBM Watson's health application, over the past 12 months, helped researchers identify as many biomarkers for ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, as researchers themselves have discovered over the past 2 years. And it did that by being able to look at large sets of data and large patient populations. It'll be great at predicting, forecasting, or modeling trends likely to develop in the future. IBM has created something called Deep Thunder, which is now able to provide meteorological forecasts down to 2/10 of a mile in 5-minute increments. So it's training itself on weather patterns and being able to get very precise forecasts. It will also be very powerful at interpreting unstructured data, images, and text in novel ways. Particularly, this will be useful for helping detect cancer cells or analyzing x-rays to detect aneurysms. It's estimated
that artificial intelligence's ability to detect colorectal cancer is now 86% accurate. And so IBM Watson and these applications are working side by side with doctors for better healthcare delivery. AI is also important in interacting with physical environments, machine-to-machine interactions, machine-to-environment interactions, and assisting humans. Already in Japan, there are hospitals and nursing care homes deploy a number of robots to work with people. But I think the most important application of AI in the near term for your economy is going to be around autonomous vehicles or driverless cars. Now, I'm from Texas, and if you Montanans are anything like us, you love your cars and you love your open roads. But I think increasingly, especially with the millennial generation, many simply see driving as the distraction. There are other things they would much rather be doing, whether it's enjoying Montana's beautiful scenery, conversing with your family, or even practicing saxophone. That's a real-life photo taken of somebody driving their car while practicing their saxophone. And I have to tell you, I would really hate to think about the consequences of unanticipated Ford airbag deployment for this individual. But seriously, we experienced 40,100 fatalities on U.S. roadways last year. It's estimated that 96% of those were caused by human error. And so if we can deploy vehicles that aren't arguing with the kids, aren't drunk, aren't disobeying speed limits, we can actually have a tremendous impact on improving safety and also enhancing mobility. A number of people can't drive if they're elderly, if they have a vision impairment, if they're young. These types of technologies really portend the ability to expand access and mobility for far more Americans. Every single major U.S. automaker has an active driverless vehicle program under development, and you will see these vehicles on U.S. roadways certainly within the next 2 years, and some of the most optimistic estimates think that we could see even as many as 10 million by the year 2021. So driverless cars are coming. You'll see them soon. I think initially more in urban environments in constrained settings, like up to 35 miles an hour. But they're coming, and I think they will have the potential to transform the tourist experience of the future. I can readily envision your visitors being picked up from the airport or from the hotel. They are driven autonomously down to Yellowstone on the way. The vehicle is narrating for them in their native language the scenery or the attractions as they go. New technologies are allowing the projection of information holographically onto dashboards. So as you're driving, artificial intelligence will be looking at the signs on the roadway and interpreting that into your visitor's native language and displaying that on the view screens. It'll be intelligent about where to drop tourists off and pick them up in the park after they've gone for a hike. Within 5 years, I would expect you'll see this, and it'll transform your tourist experience. Another really cool application you're starting to see in museums and attractions around the world is stuff like the HoloLens developed by Microsoft, which enables mixed reality experiences, enabling visitors to journey back into time at places like ancient Rome or Machu Picchu or even Yellowstone. What this is, essentially, is a picture of caves in Rome near the Colosseum, and the art on the walls has faded, but with the virtual reality goggles, you can walk through the caves, and it's showing you what the cave actually looked like at a period of time in the past. And that there is an example from that museum in Rome, where you put the HoloLens on, and you are brought to the Colosseum and experienced a gladiator, just as if you were there, with the sight, sound, audio. It's really incredible. And I can readily see the tourist office here in Bozeman or down at Yellowstone Park having a 20-minute orientation to Yellowstone using these types of mixed reality technologies. Artificial intelligence will also transform lodging. I have to tell you, I'm having a wonderful time staying at the Lark just around the corner. It's a wonderful hotel. I love the touch that there is no phone in the room. However, a number of other hotels are going in the opposite direction. Just yesterday, Marriott announced that it would be partnering with Amazon to put the Echo in hotel rooms around the country. Of course, Echo is the Alexa voice assistant, and you in the hotel experience of the future will be able to interact virtually with the in-room assistant and place your order for room service dining or more towels, or to get a room service, right? In Japan and Singapore, they're using robots to facilitate check-in or even automated robots to deliver amenities to the room. So AI in the lodging and hospitality industry will be transformative. Another really cool application that I would encourage your businesses to take a serious look at is translation. Google Translate on the phone can already translate voice or text into 103 different languages. And this startup called Unbabel is really cool. It's an online translation service using machine learning and crowdsourcing to translate businesses, customer service operations, and websites in up to 14 different languages for 0.02 cents per word. So any business here in Bozeman could use this technology to translate their website into 14 different languages and to appeal to the tourists who are visiting you from all around the world. Smart city applications, the application of information and communications technology in the city environment, things like computerized adaptive traffic lights, smart buildings, smart metering on waterways will become increasingly common. A really cool example of a smart city application, I think, is Street Bump. This was developed by the city of Boston. Essentially, it's an application for your phone, and as you drive throughout the city, if you hit a pothole, an accelerometer within the phone instantaneously recognizes it and sends this to the city, so they can kind of crowdsource and collectively get the information about all the potholes and deploy the repair people in the most effective manner. The geocode that allows this is online at Boston's website, so you could go get it tomorrow and have an application for Bozeman within a week or two if you like. Another cool example is Visalia. This is a Finnish startup company that has developed a very inexpensive sensor that can be embedded in roadways to detect black ice or icy conditions on roadways and transmit that wirelessly to traffic managers or to mobile phones. So in Finland, they're using it to get real-time roadway information about dangerous driving conditions and transmit that to the driving public instantaneously. Okay, this is not going to affect your economy tomorrow, but I think it's going to be very interesting for the future. Who is familiar with quantum computing? I should have you come up and explain it. Essentially, classic computers use binary bits of zeros or ones to process information. But quantum computers, using quantum properties such as superposition and entanglement, essentially allow the creation of qubits that can be simultaneously zero and or one. And this enables tremendous parallelism, giving them the ability to compute at speeds potentially millions of times in excess of even today's fastest supercomputers. Just last month, IBM introduced a 50-qubit quantum computer. It can only hold its state for 90 seconds, so it's pretty experimental. But they do have something called Quantum on the Cloud, where any company can go online, load their computation problem, and even now, IBM will solve it for you over the internet using quantum-based cloud computing. Some of the applications of this are going to get incredibly wild. It's theorized that if we could deploy a fully functional quantum system, it would have the ability to crack every single existing 164-key cryptographic system in the world immediately. And do you guys remember your Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Remember the idea that the photon goes through the slit and where it is, it was only determined by how the observer views it afterwards. Well, if we could apply a similar principle to communication systems, then you would be instantaneously aware if the system was tried to be hacked, because the action of observation would reveal itself instantly, and so you would know that it was trying to be hacked. China actually now has a quantum satellite communication systems, and they're implementing this. They have a $10 billion national quantum computing strategy. China clearly leads the world here. In fact, China claims, and if it's true, but they recently claimed that they had the ability to detect stealth aircraft using quantum gravitometers that were capable of recognizing the unique quantum signatures of aircraft and possibly even submarines. So it's a nascent technology, but in 10 to 15 years, it will dramatically transform the economy and defense. Finally, I think a fascinating era is life sciences. If you think about it, it was only about 15 years ago that we completed the Human Genome Project and cracked the human genome. It takes drugs about 12 to 14 years to go through a development pipeline. And so we're just now today seeing new drugs and therapies coming to market that are leveraging the knowledge of the human genome. And we're seeing some incredible things. If you're familiar with CAR T cells, chimeric antigen receptors, these can be designed specifically to latch on to cancerous cells like leukemia and target and destroy them. A technique called gene editing using CRISPR-Cas technology actually gives doctors the ability to go in and rewrite and repair broken or faulty strands of DNA. So childhood leukemia, for example, is a genetic defect, like there's a miscode in the DNA. A company called Editas Bioscience out of Boston just received FDA approval for the first gene therapy where they're going in, fixing that faulty sequence of DNA on young children and getting full remediation in the patients that are working with. Truly incredible stuff. I was in Rutgers giving a presentation last year. I met an entrepreneur there. He said he's developing a technology that gives 99.99% accurate detection of breast or lung cancer from a mouse swab in 10 minutes. Just incredible stuff. Overall, there are 7,000 new drugs under development today, many first of their kind. And the average life expectancy for babies who were born this morning is going to be 129 years. It's truly incredible. Google has something called Google Health Ventures. They have $2 billion under management. They're only signing up startup companies who will sign up to the mission of trying to expand human longevity to 500 years. So it's a fertile time for life sciences innovation. When you add all this up, I read the other day that 92% of the scientists and engineers who have ever been alive in human history are alive and innovating today. It's really a fertile time for innovation around the world. So briefly, how is Montana doing? Actually, I think pretty well. The Kauffman Foundation, a DC think tank, released its 2017 Startup Index last year, and it found that of the 25 least populated states, Montana ranked fourth in startup activity in terms of new startups younger than 5 years as a share of businesses, that it rated third in Main Street entrepreneurship, defined as the share of working age adults who own their own business. Montana does do very well in terms of startup survival and longevity. However, if there was a criticism in the report, it was that Montana ranked 20th out of the 25 in terms of growth entrepreneurship. And this was the ability to quickly scale and grow the size and employment of these startups. My own organization released a report last year called the State New Economy Index. This report ranks the 50 states on 25 indicators grouped in five categories, such as economic dynamism, globalization, knowledge jobs, the digital economy, and innovation capacity. What we found was that Montana ranked 43rd overall. I think that's a little bit unfair to Montana, because the study did put such a premium on the digital economy. We looked at things such as rate of broadband deployment, broadband speed, broadband price, which is hard for a state like Montana. Also globalization and the internationalization of your economy, I think, hurt you in this ranking. But we did find a number of good news, in particular that Montana ranked fourth for the immigration of knowledge workers, which means you're very effective at attracting smart people to come to your state. And I think Bozeman in this area is great evidence of that. You were also ranked 14th in non-industry investment in R&D, and this means that you're attracting money from the federal government, from states, from universities, for instance, for your photonics and biofilm and laser sector. So doing good at attracting non-industry capital to the region. Also, you were above average in the U.S. in terms of workforce education and patents. And if there was a thing to work on, it would be especially on foreign direct investment, kind of getting this region more known as a global hub of innovative activity and attracting more international capital to your region. You ranked, that was the worst indicator for Montana. But overall, I think the evidence is strong and that this region in particular, Bozeman, is doing very well on innovation. Okay, finally, to conclude, what would be some recommendations we'd have for local policymakers? Quickly, I would group these into three categories. First, ensuring that you have adequate digital infrastructure. Second, equipping both your students, those entering the workforce, as well as those already in the workforce with sufficient digital and future skills. And finally, as has been the theme of this day, ensuring that you embrace innovation and technological change for the future. In terms of digital infrastructure, I think you're doing great, right? You have the Bozeman Municipal Fiber Network. That's been fantastic. One challenge we see when communities do municipal fiber is that it tends only to serve the inner city and not so much the surrounding region and rural areas. Ensuring that you have an adequate plan in place to ensure good broadband speed across the entire region is absolutely vital. Don't stop with the city itself, as many communities do. Also, I understand that ensuring adequate wireless siting in Yellowstone has been a challenge. I know that's a federal issue, but for the experiences you envision for tourists, and I know there are naturalists and want to protect the park, I completely get that. Just be mindful when you have visitors from around the world, they're going to want to take photos and share them with their people back home. So finding the balance there, I think, is very important. I think the most important thing any community can do is ensure that their people has the skills necessary to compete in a global economy. A recent study by the Brookings Foundation found that already 70% of jobs in the U.S. economy require at least a medium or high level of digital skills, and that was based upon the current digital content of occupations across the U.S. economy. Yet despite this, 1 in 6 working age Americans are unable to use email, web search, or other basic online tools. I think that's potentially catastrophic for our country. If there was particular advice for Montana, it would be to make computer science classes more readily available. In 2016, Montana graduated only 75 computer science graduates from its universities. Only 11% of those were women. It was one of the weakest performances of U.S. states. What I would recommend is that Montana require all high schools to at least offer computer science classes, and that they allow students to take computer science equally as if it were biology or chemistry or physics as one of the core science requirements. However, I have to say, y'all are doing much better than California. Last year in California, more students took pottery than even took a computer science class. So that's astounding to me. And ensuring that institutions like InterMed are facilitating these conversations between business and universities to understand what types of skills are going to be required and needed in the future, and adjusting education accordingly. Finally, my last three slides. Certainly, automation and technological change will have a profound impact on employment. There is no question that people will lose their jobs through automation technologies. But paranoia about this has gotten absolutely out of hand in the U.S. economy. Larry Summers, who, if you recall, was Barack Obama's chair of the National Economic Council, recently said that as many as half of jobs could be eliminated by innovations such as self-driving vehicles, automatic checkout machines, and expert systems. Two researchers at Oxford University, Osborne and Fry, estimated that 47% of existing U.S. jobs will be eliminated by 2035 from automation technologies. And Martin Ford, in his New York Times best-selling book, The Rise of the Robots, counsels policymakers in Western societies to expect fully 75% unemployment by the year 2100. And that really sounds like quite a mass technological dystopia, doesn't it? But I think what it misses is two important points. First, these types of new technologies create new employment opportunities. If you think, if we had to color every little single pixel by hand, we'd have far fewer movies or video games, right? So these new technological systems create new employment opportunities. But what fearful predictions truly miss is that they subscribe to what economists call the lump of labor fallacy, the notion that there are only a fixed number of jobs to do in an economy, and when technology takes that job, there is no other new job to come along and replace it. And the reality is that, say, if we can deploy automation to produce a car 50% more efficiently and productively, we can sell that car for 50% of the price. That value is not lost to society. The savings from more production systems enable us to spend that money in other ways, buying a second car, buying a mobile phone, taking more trips to Yellowstone National Park, right? So what analysts miss is that automation lowers prices, which increases demand. As savings are spent, spending creates demand, and demand creates new jobs. If you think about it today, we're at a point where we have more technology and more automation than we have ever had in human history, or U.S. economic history, yet we have one of the lowest unemployment rates. And in fact, every single decade in U.S. history where we've had the lowest rates of productivity growth, like the 1970s, were when we had the highest rates of unemployment. Conversely, decades like the 1990s, when we had the highest rates of productivity growth, we've had the lowest unemployment rates, because productivity drives demand, which supports employment. My final slide. I want to share with you the experience of the United Kingdom in dealing with the challenge of automation. This is a chart that shows you the percent change in the use of robots for 13 industrialized economies over 17 industries from the year 1993 to 2007. This is correlated against the percent change in manufacturing employment over that time period. So, look at the United Kingdom. It was the country that automated the least, had the least use of robots, that experienced the highest rate of manufacturing job loss. Why? Well, it's because British companies weren't using the most advanced production systems, and so their companies were becoming globally uncompetitive and simply going out of business. In our book, Innovation Economics, we quote the head of Sweden's largest labor union. And as he says, in Sweden, we don't fear new technology. We fear old technology. Because we know that if our business is using the newest technology, some people may have to be reskilled or retrained, But the company is not going to go out of business. If we're losing old technology, we're going to not be competitive and we're going to fail. And I think that's why the best governments around the world recognize that their mission is not to ensure job security, but it is to ensure skills security, to make sure that their people have the skills they need to be competitive in a fiercely contested global economy. So I just want to conclude by saying that I hope that has left you with a few thoughts on the types of new technologies that will be coming and about how you might be able to leverage them in your community to create new customer experiences and new business models that can differentiate you and continue to make this one of the fastest or the fastest growing micropolitan area of the country. Thank you very much for your time today.